I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Cookie. I'm going to be editing this one, so you're welcome, future Hannah.
Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Marcel Cosman.
I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Neil Barnholden.
And we are gathered in person in sunny forest fire smoke-filled Edmonton with the cool coppery glow of the obscured sun overhead to talk about a movie, which you may have guessed, given the thrilling baritone of our actual friend with a film degree, Neil Barnholden.
But not just any movie.
No.
We just watched, Voldemort Origins of the Air, the 2018 fan-made prequel directed by Gian Maria Pizzato and starring a bunch of Italian people, I guess. I looked them up on IMDb, but I didn't write down their names. Rather than giving you the IMDb summary, I'm going to give you a couple of choice excerpts from the excellent Telegraph review, which called it a fun-free Harry Potter fan film, consisting of a glacially paced series of flashbacks with a vocal track frequently so out of sync as to be another film altogether. But what did we think of it? Let's find out. And because we're absolute trash, we're going to do so in a series of new segments, starting with the Diadem of Casting.
Such trash. I'm also going to take this opportunity to apologize once again, as always, to our listeners for the presence of the cat with absolutely zero chill, who is currently right now extremely distressed that we're not paying attention to her and is flopping around and going, meow, into the microphone. That was actually me just now. And you know, as I say that, she's just laying perfectly still on the carpet.
I'm so good.
I've never had anything but chill. Anyway, okay, let's talk but chill. Anyway, let's so let's talk about casting. Can I just say, before we say anything else about casting, I don't understand the function of having two women who look the exact same age playing two versions of the same character who are supposed to be two distinct ages. It didn't make any sense to me. I was very confused and thought maybe I just don't know what I'm seeing. I thought that there were two characters and there are not.
Yeah, so the protagonist of the movie is a character named Grisha McTaggan, which is what happens, I think, when Italian people make up Scottish names. It might be a real name. Who knows? And she's...
I thought it was McLagan.
Like, oh my God, maybe it was Grisha McLagan.
Grisha.
Yep, Grisha McLagan. Do we know another McLagan?
Yeah, Cormac McLagan.
Cormac.
Oh my Cormac. God. Oh my God. Is Grisha McLagan related to Cormac McLagan?
I mean, she was.
Oh, ooh, spoilers.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Commence Obliviate in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Yeah.
We will actually, I think we can hold out on spoiling this until we get later into the episode. We can, there's a twist, a pretzel twist. Anyway, so Grisha McLagan, I paid such close attention to this movie, can you tell? Is played by two different actors, one in the flashbacks when she's a student at Hogwarts and one in the present day when she's an Auror, but the woman that they cast to play her in the flashbacks is the same age as the woman that they cast to play her in the present tense, which is particularly shocking in the moment where she says, "I'm just a second year." And you're like, oh, this is porn. We're watching porn, because that's a 25-year-old woman who just sultrily said, "Oh, me? I don't know anything. I'm just a second year." Sexy hair toss.
But what's also so baffling is she's the only one who's played by two different actors with the intention of representing two different ages.
Yeah, so they keep the same riddle the whole time, possibly justified by the fact that he's already in his final year when we encounter him in the flashbacks. We don't need to justify this. It was a poor choice. Everybody was very sexy.
Sexy.
Riddle mentions, as you know, he's head boy. Just great, great dialogue. Yeah, everyone's really good looking. It's kind of weird. I mean, it's good, but, you know, I guess. I don't know. Is it good?
Not to sort of jump ahead. I'm sure we'll talk about plot more when we get to adaptation.
I'm sorry, there was a plot?
Yeah, I mean, quote unquote plot. But there is definitely an implied romance between them. And like the only point where we're told the age of the girl of Grisha at the school is when she's 12 or 11, like 11 or 12, like a second year. And like, so maybe in later scenes, like in the romantic scene between her and Tom, and I say romantic very loosely because it's an impassioned and confusing dialogue near a waterfall and there's tinkling piano music. So I take it that we're supposed to interpret that as signaling a romance that was never seen on screen and is offered only as subtext. And that, given the twist, becomes extra confusing. But maybe she's supposed to be older in that scene. Like, maybe they're supposed to be closer in age. It's 100% unclear what. Maybe he was also supposed to be a second year in that first scene where she says, "I'm just a second year." Maybe.
Well, I don't know about you, but it took me a solid 15 minutes of this hour-long movie to figure out that they were the same person.
Yeah.
A solid 15 minutes. Oh, like, yeah. We move back and forth between her in the past and her in the present, and I didn't realize they were the same person.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm remembering this right, but even in the opening sequence, which happens before the frame narrative is established, it looks like there are two different women battling. And so I was under the impression that this was going to be a movie about, like, witches. And it's not.
No.
Yeah, so, you know, it's an amateur movie. These are probably not professional actors. I looked at a number of them and they don't have other entries on IMDb. And IMDb is pretty exhaustive. So that suggests that these were sort of fans hanging out. And so we can assume like a lot of the sort of weirdness of casting comes from possibly. I mean, I say that, but then it's like just a bunch of real sexy fans who hang out together.
They're Italian. Yeah. So
maybe everybody in Italy is just this good looking.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. No, I've been to Italy. There's lots of normal looking people. Yeah. But the sort of the what ends up coming across is a almost tongue-in-cheek, like, you know, in Wet Hot American Summer, where they're supposed to be teenagers, like camp counselors, and they're all like solidly in their late 30s, early 40s, like, which just makes it absolutely incredible to watch them acting like teenagers. Like, this felt like that, but it wasn't supposed to be tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
What did we think of the actual acting? That was a trap.
I found it strained and painful to watch.
I guess I'd also like to say I thought the dialogue was also not very good, so I'm not sure how good of an actor you have to be to deliver bad dialogue well.
And also, as that excerpt from the Telegraph review indicated, they also did a very poor job of syncing up the vocal tracks with people's mouths, and so we had Neil and I were sure that it must be dubbed, and Marcel, in classic Marcel style, was like, no, I think it's just bad vocal tracks. And we were like, it's probably dubbed. And she was like, all right. If you say so. And then I looked it up and I was like, yeah, no, yeah, you're totally right. It's just badly edited vocal tracks. And she was like, yes, I know. Quietly, triumphantly write the Marcel Cosman story. Always better at reading things. So infuriating. Anyway, so all of those things combined, the sort of the very poorly written dialogue, the bad vocal syncing, sort of created a challenge, I think, for any actors. And some people, the movie prominently features a like Soviet general who is struggling to hold on to his accent. So all things combined. Did you also, you won't have noticed this on IMDb, but the voices and the actors are different. So that's part of why they're syncing so badly. So I assume it's Italian actors and English voice actors. Whoa. Yeah, so we've got like the two Grisham MacLagan and then Grisham MacLagan voice.
Oh.
Right? And like these are Italian names. Maddalena Orcali and Aurora Moroni are the actors, and then the voice is done by Amy Davies.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot of different people involved here, and that would also account for why of like it just doesn't match.
With that in mind, I think that they did a not too bad job of syncing a vocal track by completely different people with actors. That's I want to maybe be a little bit less harsh about it then, given that. A little bit less harsh, not like a lot less harsh.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about casting, but it's probably hard for those of you who haven't seen this to follow what we're talking about without knowing something about the plot. So we're just gonna sidestep over here and pick up and peruse the Locket of Adaptation. Sorry, that was the Locket of Adaptation in case you couldn't hear me laughing through it. Okay, Neil, summarize the plot for us.
If you go to Wikipedia, you're going to see a description of the plot of this movie that is significantly easier to follow. To the point of being misleading. And it's hard to kind of describe the plot of this movie without getting into the fact that the way the plot happens is really, really difficult to follow and extremely convoluted. But basically, it's that Grisha MacLagan is breaking into an Auror warehouse in Soviet Russia, I guess, to get Tom Riddle's diary. And then she's interrogated by the general who's in charge of it. And we see a series of flashbacks about her past where she was friends with Voldemort. I'm sorry, with Tom Riddle as he slowly sort of drifted away from their friendship / sort of a romance, which we didn't really see that part of. And I guess, puts together the pieces of what would become the Horcruxes in the later films. Mm-hmm. Do we want to talk about the shocking twist ending?
Let's hold off the shocking twist to the end of the segment.
Yeah, and then there's a shocking twist at the end. Yeah, but I mean, I think that's pretty accurate. Did you want to add anything?
I guess the only other thing that's like, it's not significant from a narrative perspective, but nothing in this movie is significant from a narrative perspective, which we'll have to talk about because it's kind of interesting in a way from a scholarly perspective that nothing in it is narratively interesting, like interestingly uninteresting. But the other thing is that Grisha and Tom are part of a club of the four heirs of the founders of the original houses. So she's the heir of Gryffindor, and then we also have Lazarus, the heir of Hufflepuff, and like a Viking, Wiglaf, the lead singer of The Cure, wearing some very fun eyeliner in 1945. I looked it up. That's the year that Tom Riddle finished at Hogwarts as the heir of Ravenclaw. And so the four of them, we find out, the movie is a very confusing series of embedded flashbacks where you flashback to a scene where people are describing via exposition another earlier scene. And you often don't see the original scene, so it's quite hard to follow or to fit or to piece together the chronology. But towards the end, we get some like flashbacks within flashbacks of like the four of them sitting in a forest together having a good time. So obviously they're friends at some point and like created a club about like uniting their powers to make the world better. And then it appears that gradually Riddle has been picking them off as he turned to evil.
There's this one scene where they're like, remember, we took an oath. And three out of the four of them, so not Riddle, but the other three decide to re-speak the oath. And it's something to the effect of, we are the heirs of the four houses. We take an oath to make the world better with our powers. And then Tom Riddle comes out of the shadows with a slow clap and is like, that was a great speech. The whole thing, my God, it's excruciating to watch. I'm sorry. I loved it.
It feels like this was a Kickstarter-funded, fan-made production. So like, there you go. Our review is, it's very bad. But I think from an adaptation perspective, we can talk a little bit in maybe some more interesting ways about like what it's doing and how it's functioning as fan fiction. And Neil, a point that you made a couple of times while we were watching was that the movie seems to simultaneously assume a huge amount of background knowledge because you have to be pretty deeply embedded in the fandom to like follow what's happening. And then simultaneously a willingness to suspend the fact that you know for sure how everything's going to end because it's a prequel. And that kind of made me think about critiques of like the Han Solo movie, which is like you have to care deeply about the minutiae of your fandom. And at the same time, you have to not particularly care about narrative because you know where Han Solo is going, like you know what's going to happen to him. So like, is that possibly a feature of a sort of deeply fandom embedded prequel, like a sort of lack of interest in narrative and caring much more about just like minute details of this world?
The scene that made me next question. the scene that made me think about that a lot is when I believe that we see the murder of Hepzibah Smith, which is a very minor incident in the original Harry Potter. I mean, it's important in the history of Tom Riddle, but we never see it. It's only sort of alluded to. And in this movie, we see it in a fair amount of detail. But then I think in the next scene, the concept of Horcruxes is explained to us. And so it was weird because I felt like at first, this movie spends a lot of time showing us things that we can sort of infer or that we can fill in the details of. It's filling in details, basically, of connecting dots of what must have happened to Tom Riddle and things he must have done. And that Hepzibah Smith scene is really long, despite the fact that it doesn't seem overly significant within this sort of narrative that Grisha is telling. But it really gave me a kind of weird whiplash then when the concept of Horcruxes is explained. Mm-hmm. As though, like, why would you be watching this movie if you didn't know what Horcruxes are, which is a very simple concept that was explained it's very key to the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, it would just be so strange to say, you know, here's our scene that shows you how Hogwarts was founded, and then also we're going to explain how magic works. It's like, if I care about one of these things, like if I really care about the Hepzibah Smith scene, I don't also need other things explained. But I did really feel like this movie's main drive was to link up and explain some fairly minor kind of points, or to fill in the blanks mm-hmm. between points in the original series. One of my sort of things that I didn't really like about this movie is that I don't really feel like it added anything to those stories. Even the shocking twist ending of this movie doesn't really add much, right?
It takes everything away?
Yeah. Yeah. The twist ending actually really calls into question what any of this meant.
Yeah.
And even the character of Grisha McLagan, who's sort of the movie's main addition to fandom, doesn't wind up adding anything, really.
I really like the idea of a prequel that's sort of bound within the confines, like a prequel adaptation that's bound within the confines of existing canon. I think that there's a lot of sort of like a really technically specific genre of poem where you have to work within those confines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very specific narrative constraints. And I think that as an adaptation, this movie does a terrible job of working within that structure. It feels like it was creating a whole other, like, oh my, get out of here, you cat. You're such a good kitty. Like, it feels almost like... It feels almost like the writers were trying to create a story that didn't... They were trying to create a story that then they could just put in a box. Yeah. Instead of doing an interesting job of filling in those blanks, they were like, well, here's a side story that just kind of like happens like an episode over here. And the reason you know it's connected is because we're just going to take all this other stuff that's already explained in the books and then just like bring it in so that you know that it's... So that you know it's connected, instead of like maybe weaving it together in a more engaging way.
I really like the idea of seeing Tom at Hogwarts and seeing something more about, you know, what he's like as a student and something like, because all we know is like that something happens at Hogwarts. Like that's really where sort of he takes that turn. Like by the time he's graduated Hogwarts, he's sort of set himself on that path. And all we get in the books is Dumbledore's narrative of it. And that is so clearly partial and biased. And I think the idea of like, let's see Tom as a student. Let's see him with friends. Let's see him when maybe he has some aspirations that are maybe more understandable, like before he's just a supervillain. Let's see the way that his power and ambition maybe poisons those friendships. Like, and I think that's a lot of that's there. Like, I think that's maybe the kernel of the movie is like, what if we saw him before this happened? What if we learned more about these friendships? What if we introduced, like, because there's four of them, it's like, well, what if Tom also had his own version of the Marauders, who were like kids who were sort of just up to wacky hijinks that, you know, and that there ended up being this falling out. And like, that's all kind of there. It gets really lost. And it gets really lost, I think, through a struggle to tell that story effectively and to like literally figure out how to put a narrative together in a way that holds together. But like the sort of those basic ideas of like, let's see more of this character and chart like the emotional journey through which he arrives where we know he arrives. Like, it's not a fundamentally flawed premise. Maybe not like the most narratively interesting always, but like a character study is an interesting thing, even if it's not charged by narrative.
I think also there's something interesting about the idea of applying this logic to a prequel where you know the destination mm-hmm. of the character. So if you know that a character ends up being this unfathomably evil yeah. supervillain. I mean, to me, it would be more interesting to start when they're not like that. And yeah, chart sort of work a character arc backwards almost, which is not what this movie does. Like in the scene that Marcel was describing, that's the first flashback where it seems apparent that Tom Riddle is already sort of estranged from his friends, right? He breaks Lazarus Smith's arm in that scene.
There's actually one flashback before that, which is where Grisha is excited about Quidditch, and he's like, Quidditch is dumb. And she's like, maybe you don't like it because of your muggle blood. And then the camera zooms in on his eyes and then cuts immediately to a shocked looking owl. And can I just say, reaction shot from an owl, my number one favorite filmic technique. Always, always here for an owl going like, what? Fucking loved that. I loved it. Yeah, so we get that scene right away, and he's awful to Grisha, and that's supposed to be before they're falling out, and he is an asshole. So that's, like, confusing.
It reminds me of a critique that we brought up in, I guess it was a book episode, so it was just the two of you. I can't take credit for this. But it was when we see Tom Riddle in flashback in the books, and he seems to already be evil as a child, and I think, as I recall,
we talk about this in the movie, the sixth movie episode. So you were there because we were talking about the characterization of evil, like evil 10-year-old Tom Riddle.
Okay, right. As I seem to recall, though, the critique there is that it's suggesting that the character has just always been as evil as Voldemort, and that there was never any, it's not a matter of a choice that he made. He never could have made any other choices. He was just an evil child who grew up to be an evil adult. Yeah, and I think that this movie really could have done something different and really, really didn't. I had forgotten about that Quidditch scene, but he already seems evil. And also, we don't see the characters being friends.
At the end!
We see a photo of them being friends.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
So is this an okay time to spoil the twist?
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Commence Obliviate in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, spoiler alert. You're welcome for everyone's favorite sound effect. Look at that wild cat you've got. She's wild. She's full of beans. So the twist, which when we discovered, I saw on Wikipedia that there was a twist, and so we paused and guessed, and Neil got it. So not that good a twist.
He has a film degree.
He is a famed film critic, but
It's not a good twist.
It's not a...
I was absolutely just guessing in the dark.
Yeah.
There. Like, it's
yeah.
not a good twist.
Yeah. So the twist is the most, like, sort of present tense of the movie is Grisha telling the story of all of this stuff to the Soviet general. And the twist is that it was never Grisha. It was just Voldemort in disguise, which is the stolen twist from Fantastic Beasts Somewhere to Find Them. We can't all just be like, anyway, everybody's Voldemort. Surprise. And it's revealed in a very confusing way because right at the end, the general's letting her go and says, well, first he lets her go saying that that story didn't make any sense, which is a real burn on the movie itself. And then he says, but I have one question. And you're like, dun, dun, dun. And his question is, how did you know that Tom's diary was here? And she says, I didn't, but maybe I did. And it's delivered about like that. And then a bunch of cool visual effects happen and all of a sudden she's Voldemort. And it was Voldemort the whole time. But that means, because 100% of the story was delivered to us via flashback exposition, that nothing that we have just seen is true, because it was all a story that Voldemort was telling this guy to fuck with him. So we literally don't know at the end if any of these other characters existed, if any of that actually happened, or if it was just all made up.
And that's also something that the general says, because when the general is saying, that was a very confusing story, I didn't understand that at all, who could believe such a confusing story? He also adds, like, but, you know, this is also just your story, so who even knows? It is your truth, you had all of that veritaserum, but it is just your truth, not necessarily the truth. So, like, again, general doing hours the audience's work for us, so that just in case the movie doesn't make any sense. I have a question. On a scale of 1 to Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, how bad was this adaptation? Do you guys remember the ratings that you respectively gave Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them? No, neither do I.
We gave it a rating? Oh my God, and then we had a long conversation about numbers. What I will say is that I think it actually really throws into relief how similarly hacky but better produced Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is, because the narrative flaws at the heart of this movie are the same narrative flaws in the Fantastic Beasts movie. Like, a prequel that actually adds nothing interesting or significant to the world or to the existence of any characters, an expansion of the world, and added characters that actually don't particularly do anything, and then a shitty surprise reveal where it was secretly Voldemort the whole time. Mission Impossible style, just rip off your fake face. Like, this is actually the same. Like, you've done all the same things. You just, like, it was more, certainly Fantastic Beasts was more competently made. I mean, it should be. Their budget was 4,000 times bigger, and it had a very experienced director at the helm. Like, he, you know, that makes sense. But I think it actually makes Fantastic Beasts look worse.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, though. I hadn't thought of that, but you're totally right. Those are the same problems we had. It's just that Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is just, the storytelling is better, just of that story. Yeah. But yeah, it's totally the same. And you would have no investment in these people if it wasn't for these other texts that are involved. Oh man, I just feel like it's not a great place for an adaptation to be if it, like, this movie would just make no sense whatsoever if you didn't have all this information you could fill in.
I'm reminded, I'm still, my friend Ashra had some really smart and interesting things to say about Hogwarts and Mystery, to the extent where I'm considering maybe just sitting down with her and talking about Hogwarts and Mystery and making it an episode, because she made the otherwise very shitty game much more interesting to me. But a point that she made about the game is that it is unplayable and incomprehensible without established deep knowledge of the world. And in that sense, is also, like this, deeply a fan property. That just, like, you are stepping in saying, like, you already know and care about all of this. But that does lead me back as a sort of, as a proposition of adaptation. Like,
I'm not sure if we can totally call this an adaptation because it was never meant to stand alone or to be watchable by people who aren't fans. You know, so it is a fan production, very clearly. My question is very much Neil's, like, why the fuck explain Horcruxes then? Like, why not start from what we know and expand? Why retread the same territory?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's a kind of pleasure in this text in terms of seeing things that you haven't seen before and that you didn't even really see in the books dramatized, but it's so thin. Mm-hmm. It's such a thin kind of surface level. As I remember with the trailer for this project, I was very excited by the trailer because I thought, oh, it'd be really cool to actually see these things, like we were just saying, but it's so thin because it doesn't add anything to them. Like when the murder of Hepzibah Smith happens, you just sort of think, yeah, that's kind of how I assume that happened. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Do you remember, Neil, from the book, did Hepzibah Smith also have the locket, or is that something that they added? Because when we were watching the movie, I remember thinking, oh, that's a new thing. But then afterwards, I was like, I don't even know.
Are you supposed to watch this movie with, you know, several tabs opened to the Harry Potter wiki or something? Like, I can sort of see the appeal, but I also just feel like that's such a hampering of the narrative. It just doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't add up. It's also hilarious to me that you would make a movie like this and then at the end of the movie have one of the main characters pronounce this a hopelessly convoluted narrative that no one could possibly follow or understand. I truly don't know why you would do that. It's so weird to have someone offer a really devastating critique of the movie inside the movie. I also wanted to say that I found it, I don't know if this was just a budget thing or something, but I found it very puzzling when there were scenes that they didn't show us, because it seemed logically like they should have. Mm-hmm. Like the scene of what actually happened to Wiglaf, right? We don't actually see what we're told happens to him. And I mean, again, the twist really raises questions of whether any of this happened this way, but I did find it, I mean, I'm willing to give them some credit, maybe it was just a budget thing and they just didn't have the time or the money to film it, but it's very weird that there are some scenes that are just described to us, yeah, and then other ones that are sort of enacted, mm-hmm, in a huge amount of detail.
So the way that the Soviets got the diary is that they found a chest with a skeleton in it and the diary also buried in it, and I guess died opening it because of the dark magic. And then, so at the end, after we found out that Grisha was actually Voldemort the whole time, we flash back, I think, to the team, the Soviet team, recovering the chest, pontificating on the nature of darkness, which was a very confusing scene. Does that seem to imply something about the inevitable re-rise of fascism, perhaps making this a really timely 2018 movie? Because it does seem to imply that, like, you will only ever defeat one fascist leader just in time for another one to rise. That does seem to be the moral at the end. But in a passing reference, one of the guys says, this skeleton is female, which was one, like, listen, bones, like, you did not spend enough time examining the remains to know that. Didn't even see, like, we only see like a femur, like, what's happening? But also it's a lady femur, it's very dainty. But also, so the implication there is that that's Grisha. Yeah. It's a very loose implication, but the Wikipedia plot summary confirmed our suspicion, so there you go. I guess that's supposed to be Grisha, and if so, then arguably the most important thing that happened in the entire story, which is at some point Tom turns on Grisha and murders her, but once loved her enough, seemingly, that when he tells the story of the diary, she features centrally in it, but that's left out entirely. Like, whatever actually happened between them is like, shh, 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 you don't need to know.
We're just inferring that that happened.
Yeah. So, like, you've actually told us less than we already knew.
So my theory, mm-hmm, how I choose to read this film, having discussed now with the two of you, mm-hmm, is that there were no other two founders. It was just Tom Riddle and this Grisha McLagan person, who was also probably not a founder's heir, mm-hmm. was just a regular human 12-year-old girl that Voldemort maybe had some kind of close association with, mm-hmm. be it inappropriately sexual or not. Intimacy of some kind. And so my theory is that the others just didn't even exist and is all just part of this loosey-goosey story that was very convoluted, no one would believe anyway, in order to distract the general long enough to... I don't know. I don't know. I don't understand the point of it, but I just don't think that the other characters existed. That's all I've got.
I don't want to live in a world where Wiglaf Sigurdsson isn't real. How dare you?
He fronted the band The Cure.
He is the front man of The Cure. That is a really good point about him and his groovy eyeliner.
Voldemort always comes too late.
I mean, I...
Voldemort comes too late.
I guess if you think about it in terms of what it says about the character of Voldemort, it's that he's pretending to be someone who still sees some good in Voldemort in Tom Riddle, who does not in fact exist and who he killed. Like, he killed this actual person, but he's pretending to be them and they have a sympathetic view of Voldemort. But I don't really know why he's stalling for time. I guess he's trying to get the sympathy of that general, but it's so weird when he just gets the diary.
I don't know. Sorry, I just stared into the middle distance for 30 seconds. So maybe he was actually captured, like successfully captured, and he had to bluff his way out. But he seems like the end implies that he is powerful enough to kill all of them and that he didn't need to actually be captured at all. Do you think maybe Marcel has something to add? Do you think? I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, new fan theory. Not fan theory. New film. New fan of this film theory. The reason that they have two different actors playing Grisha McLagan is because they aren't actually the same Grisha McLagan. The Grisha McLagan in the movie maybe doesn't even exist. And the bones of the woman in the trunk, where I think we can assume that Voldemort, like is looking like her before she's bones. Is any of this making sense?
No.
Okay. So the reason that there are two different actors playing that same character is because they are not, in fact, the same character. And the body that Voldemort is using to trick the general is just some other random woman's body. And it may be the body of the bones in the chest, but it may not be, whatever. The important thing is that they're not the same person. It's just that he's pretending, he's in that body pretending to be that that young girl that he once had a dalliance of some kind with. Yes, Hannah.
New fan theory.
All right, I'm ready.
The reason why they're played by two different actors is because Voldemort doesn't really remember what she looked like that well.
Oh, yeah.
He's just kind of like, I mean, all white ladies look the same, right? Like, I don't know. She was like white and like,
she had hair.
It was like kind of reddish, maybe? Hard to say.
This is also a story that Voldemort's telling where Voldemort's like, yeah, she was really into me, but I was too into this work. Too into becoming an evil wizard. Yeah. Also, there are these two other chumps, but I defeated them. Well, yeah, if you think about this story from Voldemort's point of view, that's a really, really self-aggrandizing story. Do you think Voldemort also doesn't quite remember the audio of them speaking, syncing up with the lip movements?
He can't remember what language they were speaking. And so when he thinks about it, he's just like,
That's it. He's telling the story to the best of his recollection. He was just only barely paying attention to those losers. So at the end, when the general's like, that didn't really make any sense, he's like, yeah, I know. I just like, who can keep it straight, honestly? Anyway, they're all dead now. Great. You know what? I love this movie now. Take it all back. This movie's perfect.
So I'm suddenly remembering the moment when Grisha McLeggan tells the general that Dumbledore always had a tremendous respect for Voldemort. And in the moment, I remember saying out loud, because that is not canon. And so that now makes perfect sense if it's from Voldemort's perspective, because he probably assumes everybody had a tremendous respect for him. Mm-hmm.
Incredible. It all adds up. This movie is watertight. All right. We've talked about some of the weaknesses in this movie, but I think we can all agree there's somewhere where it really excels. And that's right in here. Just look inside. Inside this cup of production. So it was pretty, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great. So moving on.
Okay. So I wonder if one of the reasons why we get so little of the actual fun, friendly backstory of the four heirs is because, you know, limited budgets are limited. They really only had three sets, right? They had the Room of Requirement, they had Hepzibah Smith's sitting room, and they had the bunker where Voldemort was being held. And then other than that, they had some like sweeping landscapes and a waterfall that was distinctly green screened. Looked like a screensaver. They just stood in front of somebody's like Windows 95 desktop. No, that's harsh. Windows 98. Was there a Windows 98? It doesn't matter. And so what I will say is that the sets that they had, with the exception of the waterfall, were quite good. Very, very believable. Would have been more believable had we spent less time there. But, you know, that's that. And I also was really into how well the oh my God, what's the word for it? The like, you know, like the spinny newspaper things and the, I don't know what the word is for those. Okay. Well, the spinny newspapers and the even, and the what? And yeah, the moving pictures in the moving picture were all very, were very, they connected really seamlessly with the actual like canon films. I think they did a really good job of that.
There were also some sort of inexplicable but good long takes of things. There's the scene where they're in the Room of Requirement talking is, I think, mostly one really long take. And I find it kind of inexplicable that you would shoot a conversation between four people as one really long take, and it results in some really bizarre blocking, like really weird, where people have their back to the camera while they're talking. Although maybe this is just dubbed afterwards. More evidence. That's about when we started to think that. But I understand it's not easy to do a long take, and that was impressive. Also, the movie starts with a really long take of a wizard battle, and that was pretty sweet. Yeah. It's a good wizard battle.
I actually think that wizard battle might have been the best scene in the movie, which is sort of unfortunate just because, one, you started with your best scene, but other movies start with their best scenes.
I'm just kidding.
Up.
Oh.
And also, Watchmen.
Oh,
yeah, the opening credits are the best part of that movie by far. Yeah, so it was lovely, but none of us had any idea what the fuck was going on. And so it was lovely, but also confusing. But in that opening scene, you really get a sense of, like, they're doing a great job of the spells. They're doing a great job of the, like, disapparation and apparition magic. Looks very cool. Like looks like a Hollywood movie. Like it's very well done. And also her costume was real cool. Yeah. And you don't get to see it for the rest of the movie, because the rest of the movie she is sitting behind a desk
And the vast majority, while we do get those scenes that are like a single long shot, the vast majority of the conversations happen with unbelievably intense face close-ups. Very frequently close-ups on people's eyes. Again, probably because they were dubbing it. And so the more you cut people's mouths out of the scenes, the easier that is to do. But the number of intense eye close-ups was quite disconcerting. But also meant that you didn't get to see as much of the sets when they were good, or of the costumes, which were also sometimes quite good.
Good special effects. I think wands are an easy effect to do badly, if that makes sense, and these were good. Yeah. That's all I had.
Well, I will say that the knitted house scarves in the breakup scene between Tom Riddle and Grisha McLagan were terrible. Because it's supposed to be 1945, and they were these like neon acrylic yarn colors. They didn't look old-timey at all. Do not approve. 0 of 10.
Fan theory. Tom Riddle doesn't know anything about knitting. So in his memory, people are wearing completely different clothing than they were.
Fan theory, Tom Riddle doesn't remember where they were when that conversation happened. So he was like, I don't know, there's a waterfall or something. Hard to say. Could have been a flying toaster. It's really hard to say.
Who even knows?
Who even knows? It's such a good thing to add to your movie at the end to be like, anyway, this was all just in some guy's head. So if any of it doesn't make sense, you know.
It wasn't relevant to his journey.
All right. It's time for our last and everybody's favorite segment, the Sword of Credits. So thanks, listeners, for joining us for whatever number of episodes this is going to be of Witch Please, Season 3, Witch Please Gone Rogue. The rest of our episodes are, as per usual, available at owitchplease.ca. The other thing you can do at owitchplease.ca is you can donate to the show, and considering all the hard work we clearly put into this episode, I think you should strongly consider doing that. This movie was free on YouTube, but I spent about $30 on snacks, so I need you to donate at least that much. Need to make back these snack money.
Special thanks, as always, to Trevor Chow Fraser, our erstwhile tech support, who is like super erstwhile this season because he hasn't done shit. And the robot of our hearts.
Hi, how are you doing?
I have no idea when this episode is going to come out, and I have no idea what other episodes we're going to make, and I don't know anything about how this season is going to unfold because it is, in fact, Witch Please Gone Rogue. But until then.
Later, witches. Or is it earlier?
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.